Jim Braden had been detained by Dallas Sheriff's deputies minutes after the assassination of John Kennedy after being found on the third floor of the Daltex building on Dealey Plaza, across the street from the building from which Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly fired at the president. Braden told the deputies that he was, quote, an independent oil dealer from Los Angeles, and that he had walked in off the street to try to find a telephone. He was released. However, Turner had suspected that there was more to Jim Braden than met the eye, so in 1967, while visiting Los Angeles, he tried in vain to find him at the two addresses given on the Dallas Sheriff's report. However, the report had Braden's California driver's license number scrawled on it, which led Turner to a posh Beverly Hills office building whose directory listed Braden under the Empire Oil Company. But the receptionist said that Braden traveled most of the time and only stopped by to pick up his mail.
Turner handed over his findings to Peter Noyes, N-O-Y-E-S, the CBS producer who had excellent sources in the Los Angeles area. Noyes obtained a three-page rap sheet under FBI number 799431, showing that Jim Braden was one of several aliases for Eugene Hale Brading, B-R-A-D-I-N-G. LAPD intelligence files revealed that Brading had hung around with mafia heavies, among them Jimmy the Weasel Fratiano, described as the executioner for the mafia on the West Coast, and the Smaldoni brothers of Denver. In 1956, the LAPD tied Brading in with two California syndicate men operating the Sunbeam Oil Company in Miami, characterizing Sunbeam as, quote, a pure front for con man schemes. Noyes also found out that Brading's Empire Oil Company also had an office in New Orleans, and that Brading was in Dallas on the day of the JFK shooting with the permission of his parole officer, who reported that Brading, quote, planned to see Lamar Hunt and other speculators while there, unquote. On the day before the assassination, Brading did see Lamar Hunt and his brother Nelson Bunker Hunt, executives of the Hunt Oil Company. The patriarch of the family, H.L. Hunt, was noted for his ultra-right-wing activism. I would add that so were Lamar and Nelson Bunker Hunt. The patriarch of the family, H.L. Hunt, was noted for his ultra-right-wing activism, and Nelson Bunker Hunt helped pay for the full-page ad in the Dallas Morning News over November 22, 1963, that showed a picture of John Kennedy with the legend, Wanted for Treason. From what Noyes was able to learn from his law enforcement sources, Brading was a syndicate courier transporting large amounts of cash around the United States and to Europe. His home base was the luxurious La Costa Country Club north of San Diego, built with Teamsters loans and run by the Las Vegas syndicate of Mo Dalitz. Following the Robert Kennedy assassination, Noyes tipped off Robert Houghton about Brading's curious background, and Houghton dispatched Chick Gutierrez to La Costa to question him. Brading admitted that he had been in Los Angeles the night RFK was shot, but claimed he was at the Century Plaza Hotel a half-hour drive from the ambassador. Special Unit Senator was apparently satisfied with the alibi, for Houghton chalked up the matter to historical coincidence, unquote. In Special Unit Senator, his book, the chief alluded to Brading by saying, quote, in addition to his mafia and oil contacts, he was friendly with far-right industrialists and political leaders of that area. Meaning the Texas area. Well, a number of interesting things about Eugene Hale Brading. Not only the fact that he was very close to this fellow Edward Glenn. Now recall that Edward Glenn co-manages this fighter O'Reilly with Jerry Owen. Glenn in turn pals around with Brading alias Braden. Okay. Now Braden is stopped in Dealey Plaza on the day of the John Kennedy assassination. Admits that he's also in L.A. During the Robert Kennedy assassination. And his contacts include not only numerous organized crime figures, but also the Hunt brothers, ultra-right-wingers who figured in the assassination of John Kennedy. Yeah, there are numerous connections between the Hunts and Jack Ruby, among others, and we really haven't got the space here to go into the Hunt's role in the JFK assassination, but it was prominent, and it's well-documented. We'll, in our next couple of Radio Free America broadcasts, go into the Hunts in connection with the John Birch Society. With a couple of other interesting details here now. This fellow, Braden, is, recall now Edgar Eugene Bradley, the fellow who Garrison tried to have extradited, who knew Jerry Owen, and who was not extradited by Ronald Reagan. Roger Craig, the Dallas policeman who identified Edgar Eugene Bradley in another sort of photo identification session, was shown a picture of Braden, who has a very close resemblance to Edgar Eugene Bradley, and he, the second time, identified the person who had stopped this person coming out of the Texas School Book Depository and with phony Secret Service credentials as Braden. Now, the two of them are not only Bradley and Braden, that is, or Brading, are not only virtual doubles, but lived in almost the same section of Los Angeles. So there's an interesting set of coincidences here that both men apparently were in Dallas, Texas. Both men were very, very similar in appearance and lived very close to each other in Los Angeles. And again, both move in the same circles as the Reverend Jerry Owen.
And have very similar names, Edgar Eugene Bradley, Eugene Hall Brading. Okay, going on, now we're going to talk about another character, a much more well-known character to the average Californian, especially if you're above a certain age. Oh, yes.
Just one detail. People would like to check out the Braden-Bradley connection. Check out the book by Robert Noyes, Legacy of Doubt, by the fellow mentioned here.
Okay. Again, a character well-known to Californians of a certain age, a man by the name of Sam Yorty, who used to be the mayor of Los Angeles. And for quite some time, and as was mentioned earlier in the book, earlier in the broadcast, he does crop up in this assassination investigation a number of times. As we're going to talk about later, he was prominent in the movement to paint Sirhan Sirhan as a communist, and then later as some kind of an occult, black magic lunatic type. And we'll talk about that a little later. But one of the interesting things is that at the time that the Jerry Owen bit of the story, that all of a sudden somebody had who even... although the truth behind Owen's actions had not come out yet, but even when Owen was at least important because he was the only person who admitted to having seen Sirhan Sirhan, before and talking about the assassination site and the whole thing. Anyway, Sam Yorty basically sort of glossed over the whole thing. Special Unit Senator, their reaction we talked about. Anyway, but it turns out that Sam Yorty happened to be friends with Jerry Owen, as we're going to find out here in a moment. Anyway, John Christian, one of the authors of the book, was sitting around several months after their assassination investigation had begun, just watching television. Suddenly, on Channel 13, the authors write, a station break faded and Mayor Yorty came on. Quote, "How do you do, ladies and gentlemen," he began. "It's a great privilege to present to you my friend, evangelist Jerry Owen, the Walking Bible. Glad to see you, Jerry." Christian watched stupefied as Owen strode into camera range and slipped a thick arm around Yorty's shoulder. "Thank you, Mayor Yorty, and I'm glad to have you here," Owen beamed. "Mayor, I know of several thousands of God-fearing people that prayed you would be elected, and I believe God answers prayer, don't you, Mayor?" Yorty grinned sheepishly. He had just won re-election against black city councilman Thomas Bradley after mounting a campaign that appealed to white prejudices. Quote, "Well, I certainly do," Yorty finally agreed. "Of course, I was doing a little of that praying myself, along with thousands." He emitted a strained chuckle. A grinning Owen kept up the patter. Quote, "And I'd like to ask you another question, Mayor. Don't you believe that America, the world, needs to put their faith and trust in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob like never before?" Yorty, not used to the role of straight man, hemmed and hawed. "Well, Jerry," he said, "I think that this is one of the missing links that's causing so much disturbance and turmoil today, especially of young people. I think they sort of lost their moorings, and too many have gotten away from belief, a real belief in a supreme being and a direction to all the affairs of human beings." Christian, the author, was bewildered. What was the one-time congressman, three-time mayor of Los Angeles, twice a candidate for governor of California, doing fumbling around with Owen? The question answered itself. 8 months before, Yorty had not even acknowledged Jack Brown's memorandum concerning Owen. 4 days previously, Brown had been ousted when he again recommended that the Owen angle be looked into. Yorty hadn't just walked in on the television debut of The Walking Bible. Somehow, he and Owen were old friends.
Now, the significance of the Owen-Sirhan friendship for the assassination of Robert Kennedy will become very clear here in just a minute. And again, the significance of Owen being connected with all of these different people, and in turn all of the connections that we're delineating here, supposedly Sirhan Sirhan was a disenchanted Palestinian who killed Robert Kennedy because of his friendly policy towards Israel. No connections whatsoever, supposedly, to Sirhan Sirhan, as with all of our other faceless lone nuts. Well, again, this web of connections that we're delineating here is significant. I think its significance is quite obvious, but it totally destroys the thesis presented, which is that this was an apolitical killing. Again, recall the Owen and Sam Yorty relationship. Now, Yorty was one of a number of different people and organizations were involved in painting Sirhan as a communist and also as an occultist and sort of as a communist hyphen occultist, okay, as silly as that might sound. The fact of the matter is that this PR campaign went a long way towards fixing the notion in the public's mind that Saran was some sort of leftist or fellow traveler, and this, of course, is very similar to the way in which Lee Harvey Oswald was treated, too, following the assassination of John Kennedy, although eventually he turned out to be a, quote, lone nut, unquote, according to the official version. Initially, all sorts of leftist ties were bruited about, or alleged leftist ties, and this is very similar to the way Saran was handled. Sam Yorty, one of those who painted Saran red. Turner and Christian write, within hours of the shooting, a campaign was underway to paint Saran a deep red. The chief brush wielder was Sam Yorty, the cocky bantam rooster mayor of Los Angeles. Yorty had a reputation for sounding off on practically every issue. During the height of the Vietnam War, he made two inspection trips to Saigon and returned with hawkish pronouncements on the necessity to increase the American military commitment. Wags dubbed Los Angeles the only city with its own foreign policy. The Kennedy brothers had long been near the top of Yorty's enemies list. In 1960, despite his nominal Democratic affiliation, Yorty had endorsed Richard Nixon over JFK, and in 1965, he had clashed with RFK during a Senate hearing. In 1968, he was again in Nixon's corner. Ironically, Christian had been a kind of unofficial campaign advisor to Yorty in 1966, called in by a former colleague of friend Paul Smith. Christian didn't know that Yorty was such a hard-line right-winger when he agreed to advise him. However, he soon found out how deep ran the waters of political intrigue when he learned that the so-called maverick mayor had a double strategy. Yorty intended to win, if he could, in the Democratic primary against the incumbent Edmund G. Pat Brown, father of Jerry Brown. But in case he didn't win, he was mounting a mudslinging and red-baiting campaign that he hoped would alienate conservative Democrats from Brown during the November election. In fact, Yorty held five secret strategy meetings with the Republican standard-bearer, Ronald Reagan, to divide the Democrats from within. The plan worked. After Brown barely disposed of Yorty in the primary, he was battered by a vicious assault from the right in the general election and was handily beaten by Reagan. During the mid-morning of June 5, 1968, as Robert Kennedy lay comatose in the hospital, Yorty appeared before network television cameras with Chief of Police Thomas Redden, resplendent in his gold-braided uniform, sitting solemnly by his side and nodding in approbation. He revealed that according to a reliable police informant, unquote, a car traceable to suspect Saran had been seen several times parked in front of the W.E.B. Du Bois Clubs, a leftist young people's group. The implication was that the man responsible for Kennedy's shooting was a left-wing radical. What Yorty neglected to point out was that the Du Bois Clubs were moribund and had vacated that address over a year before. One of Saran's brothers owned the car and played in the band at an Arabian nightclub a couple of doors away. Saran used the car frequently because his beat-up DeSoto was forever breaking down and visited his brother at the Hollywood Boulevard location on many occasions.
Following the television appearance, Yorty showed up at the field command post set up in the LAPD's Rampart Division, not far from the Ambassador Hotel. The mayor began sorting through material the police had just brought in from a warrantless search of Sirhan's room in the family residence in Pasadena. His attention centered on some Rosicrucian literature. Sirhan had recently applied for membership in that mystical society, and a pair of spiral notebooks filled with repetitive and often disjointed handwriting that indicated strong occult affinities. As Yorty left the police station, he was cornered by several members of the press. Quote, "What can you tell us about Sirhan Sirhan?" one asked. "Well," the mayor replied, "he was a member of numerous communist organizations, including the Rosicrucians." "The Rosicrucians aren't a communist organization," a newsman corrected. In fact, it would turn out that Sirhan had never been affiliated with any communist-oriented group. Quote, "It appears," Yorty amended, "that Sirhan was a sort of loner who harbored communist inclinations, favored communists of all types. He said the U.S. must fall," indicated that RFK must be assassinated before June 5, 1968. Yorty had excerpted passages from the spiral notebooks, but at this point no one had verified that they were actually written by the man in custody. In parentheses, there would remain a question of their authorship even after Sirhan was tried and convicted in 1969. Evidential niceties didn't faze the lawyer mayor. Returning before the television cameras, Yorty brandished the notebooks and flipped through pages, reading off entries that he thought sounded communistic. Quote, he does a lot of writing, pro-communist and anti-capitalist, anti-United States, he commented. No one in the vast television audience could fail to get the message that Sirhan had been inspired to his deed by his communist sympathies and occult dabblings. State Attorney General Thomas C. Lynch phoned Yorty to register concern that his televised statements, quote, referred to evidence that would have to be ruled upon by the court. And prominent local lawyers upbraided him for, as one put it, quote, your lack of understanding of the fundamentals of American justice. But the irrepressible Yorty would not be muzzled. He held another press conference at which he dwelt at length on the notebooks and their, quote, timetable to kill Kennedy. Sirhan, he said, was, quote, inflamed by contacts with the Communist Party and contacts with communist-dominated or infiltrated organizations. Both Yorty and Redden went to great pains to convey that RFK's assassination had virtually been his own fault. Why? Because, they insisted, the presidential aspirant had allegedly told the LAPD that he wanted no police protection during his visits to Los Angeles. Thus, they said, no members of the LAPD had been present at the Ambassador Hotel at the time of the shooting. Apparently, none of the newsmen present gave any thought to the laws pertaining to the LAPD's responsibility for, quote, public safety and, quote, crowd control that should have applied to the gathering that night. The hotel housed no fewer than three major political candidates, Robert Kennedy, Senator Alan Cranston, and Max Rafferty. Their supporters covered the spectrum from extreme left to far right, the makings of potential spontaneous turmoil and violence. It was also strange that no one in the RFK campaign entourage could recall anyone, Robert Kennedy included, having called off LAPD protection. But no one stepped forth to challenge the contentions of the Yorty-Redden press conference. The impression that prevailed was that RFK had somehow managed to orally sign his own death warrant.
So look up Yorty's behavior here, and again, recall his connection to Jerry Owen. He goes in there in total contravention of legal procedure. He walks in, begins handling evidence and interpreting evidence in front of movie cameras before a suspect has come to trial. As the text here indicates, that is a total departure from legal procedure. It's grossly illegal. It's worth noting, too, that the place where this evidence was being stored was the Ramparts Division headquarters, the Ramparts Division branch of the LAPD. Now, that significance is going to crop up again later in the broadcast because the fellow in command of the Rampart Station was Ed Davis, okay? And Ed Davis went on to become chief of police of Los Angeles and is now a state senator with higher aspirations and is also affiliated with General Daniel Graham and Fritz Kramer in the Star Wars program. So a very significant fellow, Ed Davis, and again, he crops up in connection with the assassination. We'll talk about that later in the broadcast. Now, another interesting connection of Sam Yorty's is the fact that Sam Yorty was also affiliated with an occult sort of guru type and a hypnotist, and most significantly a master hypnotist, named Manly Palmer Hall. I'm going to reread a section that you heard on the taped segment from our previous Radio Free America show about mind control, this in the taped segment about Sirhan's mind control. Again, about the association between Sirhan, Manly Palmer Hall, and Yorty. Conveniently omitted was the fact that a police search of Sirhan's car yielded a volume entitled Healing the Divine Art by Manly Palmer Hall, founder of the Philosophical Research Society. The book mysteriously disappeared from the grand jury exhibits. Hall, a man with penetrating eyes, chiseled features, and a Buddha-like figure, was a master hypnotist with a practice in hypnotherapy. Some time ago, he gained considerable publicity from hypnotic antics, on one occasion putting under a movie actor and convincing him he was suffocating, with the result that the actor tore apart a movie set in his frantic search for air. We queried Sirhan in San Quentin about Hall and his society. He wrote back that he remembered paying several visits to the headquarters in Alabaster Temple near Griffith Park. The secretary there had a distinct foreign accent, he said. Hall's wife is German-born, and I had to ask her to unlock the bookcases for me to get the books. I wanted to read in the library. I remember seeing Manly Hall himself there. Sirhan's dabbling with the occult society is by itself innocuous, but there is a certain irony in the fact that he was drinking from the same mystical fountain as Sam Yorty. For some two decades, the mayor had been a student of Hall, whom he regarded as his guru. So again, supposedly Saran has no connections to anybody, and yet look at the connecting links between Saran, Yorty, Jerry Owen, and of course Jerry Owen's links to Bradley, to Braden, and other figures from the John Kennedy assassination. And these connecting links not only between supposedly unrelated key participants in the Robert Kennedy assassination, but or key figures, I should say, in the Robert Kennedy assassination, but also between key figures in that assassination and other assassinations as well. It's a pattern we've seen before, and we're going to see more of it.
Okay. Now we're going to look at, again, as Dave said, some more of these patterns cropping up again. Again, we're continuing with the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, skipping down a little bit. While Yorty was holding forth downtown on the morning of June 5th, a group calling itself American United called a press conference in Westwood near the UCLA campus. American United was the two-man show of John Steinbacher, a John Birch Society propagandist and part-time reporter for the Anaheim Bulletin in Orange County, and Anthony J. Hilder, a firebrand activist. Both were protégés of the well-known anti-Semite Myron J. Fagan, a leader of the Hollywood blacklisting clique during the McCarthy era. In fact, Hilder and a gaggle of followers had been at the Ambassador Hotel the previous night trying to race-bait RFK by handing out buttons and pamphlets depicting him and black Congressman Adam Clayton Powell Jr. of New York on the same ticket. After the shooting, the Hilder group created considerable confusion by alleging that the assailant was a Eugene McCarthy supporter. Okay, now, skipping back here to the section that... back here. Oh, do we go ahead there?
No, just go ahead and okay. read that footnote
okay,
there.
Okay, we're just going to go to a footnote then. This is from a letter signed by Anthony J. Hilder, April 7th, 1968, mailed from 1141 North Highland Avenue, Hollywood, California, 9038. Foundation researcher Walter Carithers informed us in 1971 that American United once used the address P.O. Box 285, Woodland Hills, California, on some of its Illuminati record albums. This is the same address on the letterhead of Eugene Bradley Defense Fund, an ad hoc group of right-wing preachers raising money to defend him against the charges levied by D.A. Jim Garrison in the JFK assassination case. One of the signatories of a fundraising letter sent out in July 1968 was Orange County evangelist Dr. Bob Wells. In his 1968 interview with Jerry Owen, Turner asked if the preacher knew Wells. Quote, "Very well. He don't live far from me. Know him well." Did Owen know of the Bradley-Wells tie-in? I think Bradley was to speak for him once. So, again, it's just it's virtually impossible to escape the sort of the right-wing milieu that keeps cropping up in the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. Again, one has to, of course, still question, because the information is not complete, what exactly the connections are, what exactly the involvement of these various people are. But the ripple effect that goes out from what was supposedly a lone assassin at the center, namely Sirhan, back out to some of these people like Steinbacher and Hilders, we're going to hear about in a little bit of a moment, more and more has to lead one to at least question exactly what kind of a lone nut was Sirhan.
Well, and take a look, too, at the interesting ways in which all these people connect up. Now, Hilder and Steinbacher are outside the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy gets killed, create confusion by maintaining that the assailant was a Eugene McCarthy backer. Worth noting also that these guys held a press conference, albeit unattended, in which they were portraying Saran killing Robert Kennedy as an Illuminist-communist killing. I'm not even going to bother to try and explain the philosophy, but, again, it equates communism as a sort of an occult originated philosophy and sort of spins the occult and communism and socialism up into a milieu which I'm not even going to bother to try and relate it, but they regard them as all being related, and in turn most progressive forces as being, you know, somehow dupes or tools of this communist Illuminist conspiracy. Now, note, not only are they outside the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy gets it and then holding a press conference to try and paint Saran red, but that their address used on some of their record albums that they sent to senators was none other than the very same address used for the Edgar Eugene Bradley Fund. And it's worth noting, too, that, of course, Jerry Owen connects back up with the Edgar Eugene Bradley situation. So, again, all of these groups fitting into a pattern which we've looked at before and we're going to continue to look at right now. One of the most significant people in terms of painting Lee Harvey Oswald red was a guy named Ed Butler, okay? And Ed Butler was basically Well, an Army intelligence agent who had, before we get on to Ed Butler, actually, I think one more piece of information here as we go through the reams here. Staying with Hilder and Steinbacher for just a couple of minutes before we move on to Ed Butler. Not only did Hilder and Steinbacher, were they outside of the Ambassador Hotel and then painting Saran red, but interestingly enough, they also, Hilder, that is, was involved with hypnosis. Recall Manly Palmer Hall, connected to Sam Yorty, also connects to Saran. Question and possibility of Manly Palmer Hall being with Saran's hypno-programming. Hilder also was a very active student of hypnosis. Returning to the assassination of Robert Kennedy, we had no direct information that Owen knew Steinbacher and Hilder, or for that matter, that Steinbacher and Hilder had ever laid eyes on Saran. But we did learn that Hilder, who had been at the Ambassador Hotel on election night passing out anti-Kennedy handbills, had acquired more than a passing interest in hypnosis. In discussing the possibility that his programmer might have discovered Saran at a hypnosis school or demonstration, Hollywood hypnotist Gil Boyne mentioned to Christian that he himself held a self-help institute using hypnosis in the fall of 1967 that attracted several political extremists who might have seen some potential in Saran. One that Boyne named was Anthony Hilder. Hilder signed up for instructions for himself and a girlfriend, explaining that he wanted to find out the nature and effect of hypnosis on the individual. After attending several classes, they dropped out. Then in December of 1967, he came to see Boyne. I seem to have lost some material here. Anyway, here we go. Okay, it's got it misplaced. Excuse me. Let me read that one again. Again, we have a ton of material here, and got a couple of our cards shuffled in the deck here, so just bear with the bumpiness here. We just got a little bit confused in our pecking order here and our order of battle, and let me read the last few sentences again. Again, talking about the association between Anthony Hilder and Hollywood hypnotist Gil Boyne. Hilder signed up for instructions for himself and a girlfriend, explaining that he wanted to find out the nature and effect of hypnosis on the individual. After attending several classes, they dropped out. Then, in December of 1967, he came to see Boyne, and I think I'm still lost here. No, I got it. Okay, one more. Sorry about this. He came to see Boyne wild-eyed and agitated, muttering about something political. He whipped out a .38 police special and two boxes of shells and offered them to the frightened Boyne as payment for arrears tuition. Hilder confided that Boyne would soon have great need for the weapons because an event would occur that would touch off race riots around the country. But Hilder had been quite insistent that he not be placed under hypnosis himself. He knew big things, he said, and he didn't want them to come out. Interesting behavior before the assassination of Martin Luther King, which, of course, did touch off race riots. And, again, the question of a possible connection between Hilder and Steinbacher and the conspirators in that assassination has to be asked here. And, once again, another link with the other assassinations, possibly. And certainly another ultra-right winger moving in Hollywood hypnosis circles. And that, along with Manly Palmer Hall, adds yet another possibility towards Saran's hypno-programming.
And now we move on to the aforementioned Mr. Butler and some of his interesting contacts and the fact that, of course, well, we'll get to Butler. I'll explain in a moment. Let me just read here for a bit. At 7:15 on the evening after the RFK shooting, a compact man with goggle eyeglasses marched into LAPD headquarters with four companions. He gave his name as Major Jose Antonio Duarte and said he and his men were, quote, freedom fighters against Fidel Castro. A Cuban exile, Duarte reported that on May 21st he had attended a leftist meeting because he knew that support for Castro was on the agenda. When he rose to speak out, he said, a small, olive-skinned young man angrily accused him of being a CIA agent, and they got into a shoving match. The young man was Sirhan Sirhan. Duarte tried to unload his story on the media, but it was ignored. Then, on June 11th, the Anaheim Bulletin headlined, Pro-Castro Link to RFK Slaying. The article, written by Duarte's political associate John Steinbacher, and of course Anthony Hilder's political associate John Steinbacher, recounted the Cuban's putative encounter with Sirhan. Steinbacher arranged radio appearances for Duarte, and in an instant paperback book, Senator Robert Francis Kennedy, The Man, The Mysticism, The Murder, summed up, quote, Mayor Sam Yorty of Los Angeles has already brought out the pro-communist inclinations of Sirhan. But it was left to Major Jose Duarte, the Cuban anti-communist, to link Sirhan with the riots and unrest in our nation today, unquote. In time, the LAPD discredited Duarte's identification of Sirhan by producing a look-alike Iranian student who had been at the leftist meeting and recalled being involved in the altercation. However, the entire scenario struck us as all too familiar. In August 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald was accosted by an anti-Castro exile while handing out pro-Castro literature on the streets of New Orleans. Shortly after the scuffle, Oswald was invited to participate in a radio debate on the subject. In the evening of the day John Kennedy was shot, taped excerpts were broadcast nationally and Oswald was heard by millions proclaiming, "I am a Marxist." Both the debate and the assassination evening airing of the excerpts were arranged by Edward S. Butler, who headed a right-wing propaganda outfit in New Orleans called the Information Council of the Americas. And before I go on, I should just mention that those of you who listened to Guns of November, when we did that special in November of 1983, which we can get you copies of, as we mentioned earlier, actually heard that broadcast, which we had a tape of, and we played it. You hear Richard Butler, Lee Harvey Oswald, and Carlos Bringier, and the whole shot. Anyway, by 1968, Butler, the man who arranged this whole thing and put it on the air, by 1968, Butler had moved to Los Angeles, where he carried on with financial aid from Patrick J. Frawley, Jr., chief executive officer of the Schick Safety Razor Company. For years, Frawley generously supported hardline conservatives such as Ronald Reagan, Barry Goldwater, and Sam Yorty. Frawley and Yorty belonged to the American Security Council, an embodiment of the military-industrial complex that lobbied for a bigger military establishment and ran a political blacklist service for its large corporation clients. Anthony Hilder also claimed to have the backing of Frawley, and Butler was present when Steinbacher and Hilder held their unattended press conference. Thus, a right-wing clique colored the facts and conjured up visions of a sinister occult cabal to depict Sirhan as the pawn of an international plot. As the Anaheim Bulletin rhetorically asked in an editorial, quote, "Are foreign influences at work to conquer this country? Is a hidden plot progressing to eliminate the liberal leadership of the country and throw the movement completely into control of communist agents?" Anyway, just again, some evidence again of the same thing, what we've been talking about, and the presence of Butler, very interesting because of his earlier affiliation with the rather spurious branding, self-branding by Lee Harvey Oswald of himself as a pro-Marxist, again, handing out pro-Castro leaflets for a pro-Castro group of which he was the president and only member in New Orleans, and then getting into a fight with an anti-Castro Cuban and resolving it by going onto the air to proclaim his Marxism, and then that tape managed to get back onto the air on the night of the John F. Kennedy assassination, so the entire country could hear Lee Harvey Oswald proclaiming his Marxist sympathies. Okay, by the way, you are listening to KFJC 89.7 in Los Altos Hills.
Again, take a look at the milieu that we're looking at here. Hilder and Steinbacher outside the Ambassador Hotel when Bobby Kennedy gets shot, holding a press conference painting Sirhan red. Ed Butler, who functions in the same capacity with Lee Harvey Oswald, shows up at this very same press conference. Ed Butler, who transfers to the West Coast under the stewardship of Frawley, William Frawley, who is a sponsor of, among others, Sam Yorty and Ronald Reagan, the Ronald Reagan who does not extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley. Note that Hilder also boasts of the backing of Henry Salvatore, a key backer of Ronald Reagan's as well. And again, recall that Hilder basically was studying hypnosis and may have had connections to the assassination of Martin Luther King. Again, an interesting tangle of personalities and organizations.
And I just wanted to mention, in case you've just tuned this in recently, you've been hearing a lot of talking here, and I just gave the station identification at the top of the hour, but you may not know what you're listening to. This is Radio Free America. I'm Nip Tuck. And with Dave Emery here in the studios at KFJC, and what we're doing tonight is the 17th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, and we're conducting a bit of an investigation into the facts surrounding his assassination and some of the untold story, I suppose. So anyway, so if you're wondering what you've tuned into, that's what it is, and Radio Free America is a monthly feature on KFJC, and of course Dave's and my program One Step Beyond is a weekly feature on Sunday evenings.
Right, and again, this is an awful lot to try and assimilate at one sitting. These programs are put together this way so you can tape them and study them at your leisure. Hopefully some or all of you are doing that, because it's a very important thing to do, and again, this is a sort of an innovative form of broadcasting that we're doing here at KFJC, and We don't expect people to be able to recall this off the top of their heads. If you can, more power to you. I can't do it. So please, if you haven't begun already, do tape the program. And if, for those of you who haven't heeded our warnings or encouragements or whatever, we do have all of these shows on file, and we'll have this one too, so that you can order it and check. Well, by the way, we don't make any money out of this. This is simply as a service to the listeners. But again, it's an awful lot of information to try and just sit down, listen to, and assimilate. So taping is the order of the day here. Now, it's worth noting also that the anti-Castro Cuban milieu, which figured so prominently in the John Kennedy assassination, and again, we talk about that in our Guns of November broadcasts about the JFK assassination, also crops up in connection with Saran Saran. Now, the Major Duarte, who, again, was associated with Hilder and Steinbacher and talked about Saran being a communist and so forth, touches on this very same anti-Castro milieu, and that also figures, perhaps, in the background of Saran Saran. One of the places where Turner and Christian speculate that Saran may have hooked up with the right-wingers who obviously were manipulating him was at the Corona breeding farm. Now, that was a horse breeding farm owned in part by Desi Arnaz. Desi Arnaz, the television star, who, of course, was with Lucille Ball for many years on a syndicated sitcom, basically was came from a wealthy Cuban family, as will be indicated here, and was very, very violently opposed to Fidel Castro and was very, very conservative politically. And Saran worked at a ranch owned in part by Desi Arnaz. This basically, the Corona breeding farm may have been where Saran hooked up with the ultra-right wingers who appear to have manipulated him. Turner and Christian write, in the spring of 1966, Saran quit his job at the racetracks because he felt he wasn't getting anywhere. Shortly thereafter, he scribbled in his notebook, I have secured a position as assistant to the manager of Corona breeding farm. Desi Arnaz's resident Saran, $600 per month. The farm was actually the Granja Vista del Rio Ranch near Corona, owned by a group that included Desi Arnaz, the former husband of Lucille Ball. The ranch bred and trained racing horses. Saran purportedly secured the job through a Frank Donnarumas, Donnarumas, whom he had known at the Santa Anita track and who reputedly was a relative of the ranch manager, Bert C. Altfillish. Donnarumas' true name was Henry R. Ramistella, R-A-M-I-S-T-E-L-L-A, but he had employed the alias to hide a long rap sheet acquired in New York and Miami. Donnarumas was Saran's boss at the ranch, and according to co-workers, the two became quite friendly. In one of Saran's notebooks was the passage, happiness, happiness, Donna, Donnarumma, Donnarumma, Frank Donnarumma, please pay to the order of Saran, Saran, the amount of five. After the assassination, the FBI interviewed one of Saran's co-workers, Terry Welch, who listed Desi Arnaz, Buddy Ebsen, and Dale Robertson, prominent television personalities, as horse owners who were well acquainted with Saran. All three actors were prominent in Hollywood's more conservative political circles. Desi Arnaz came from a wealthy Cuban family and was a fervent opponent of Fidel Castro. Welch pegged Saran as a staunch anti-communist. In conversations with fellow employees who were refugees from communist countries such as Cuba and Hungary, Saran always gave Welch the impression that he was very much opposed to communism, the FBI report stated. He indicated a strong liking for the United States and never exhibited any particular loyalty or feeling toward the country of his birth. Welch said that the Reverend Leo Hill, Circle City Baptist Church, 9th and Sheridan, Corona, would possibly know Saran inasmuch as Saran gave Welch a card for this church and suggested that he see Reverend Hill when he was having personal problems. Hill's church subsequently merged with the large Riverside Baptist Church, a pillar of the fundamentalist right, and we located him there. Saran attended services a couple of times, the Reverend recalled, but as far as coming to me personally, he never did that. It is not difficult to envision how Corona, with its mix of its horse crowd, Hollywood actors, fundamentalist religionists, and political conservatives, might have been the locus where Owens and Saran's paths first crossed. And in a footnote to that sentence, Turner and Christian add, a possible linkage might have been Owen's close ties to Jerome Weber, the lawyer for Desi Arnaz, and Saran's claim to having been employed at the actor's thoroughbred horse ranch. And Jerome Weber, his ties to Saran, and or ties to Jerry Owen, and in turn to Ebel Younger, the DA who prosecuted Saran, is something Nip's about to tell you about.
Okay, now, the man, the deputy attorney general at the time is a man by the name of Charles O'Brien, and the attorney general Lynch was leaving office. O'Brien was his hand-picked successor, and one of the last things that anybody wanted to happen was to have this Kennedy case blow up. But O'Brien himself was interested in the case and had been been kept abreast by some of the people who had found some of the new evidence in the case.
In addition, I recall that Charles O'Brien was the deputy attorney general who reviewed the Garrison extradition request for Edgar Eugene Bradley and recommended that it be granted. He also, interestingly enough, was very high on Robert Kennedy's list for a possible attorney general after Robert Kennedy got elected president.
Indeed. Now, O'Brien was, Christian and Turner Wright, was pitted against Evel Younger. And although it was not a motivating factor in his desire to reopen the case, he realized that it could tip the scales. If a grand jury was merely convened, it would be politically embarrassing to Younger because of his role in prosecuting Sirhan and shutting down the conspiracy angle. Excuse me. And if a grand jury returned indictments, Younger's whole political future, he intended to run for governor eventually, could go up in smoke. But to simply make a campaign issue out of the assassination was a different matter, and O'Brien's brain trust counseled against it. What baffled us, however, was O'Brien's reticence to exploit another whiff of scandal that had been hanging over Younger's head for some time. The central figure was a high-powered Beverly Hills attorney named Jerome Weber, whose clientele numbered celebrities such as Desi Arnaz and crime syndicate kingpins such as Frank M. Big Frank Matronga of San Diego. Interestingly, Weber was a past president of the Saints and Sinners Club, whose meeting Jerry Owen purportedly attended as he waited to sell Sirhan the horse. In other words, that's the two different stories that Owen was telling. The one that he went to a Saints and Sinners Club dinner, of which Desi Arnaz's attorney Jerome Weber was the was a past president of, and Owen's other story was that he told the Reverend Jonathan Perkins that he was actually waiting in the Ambassador Hotel parking lot. And Jerome Weber was Owen's first attorney in the suit against KCOP Television. And we'll talk about that a little later on. The potential scandal revolved around Thomas E. Devins, a former parking lot attendant who had talked a wealthy widow out of a large chunk of money and then taken her to Europe, where she disappeared. Her remains were later found in the Swiss Alps. An indictment for murder was pending against Devins. Weber told him that he could quash the case through his, quote, influence inside the DA's office. According to grand jury testimony, Weber's asking price was $35,000, of which $25,000 would go to two top DA investigators. To demonstrate his, quote, control of the situation, the attorney said he would have a pesky DA investigator transferred so that his, quote, two top investigators, unquote, could take charge. The transfer went through. Then Weber told Devins that he had arranged for senior investigator George Murphy to accompany the investigator to control an out-of-town interview. We consider this of more than passing interest, since Murphy and Chief Investigator George Stoner had been Younger's two top men on the RFK case and had put down Owen as nothing more than an unfunny clown. Devins paid part of the money, but then, perhaps sensing a double cross, went to the Attorney General's office and complained of being blackmailed. O'Brien's agents hid a transmitter in his clothing and sent him in to bargain further with Weber. The attorney produced a confidential report from the DA's office to prove his connections. Devins expressed skepticism. Quote, have they ever failed to come through? That is, have they ever taken any bread and then that's it? No, 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 Weber replied. Never in a million years. Weber was convicted of bribery and eventually disbarred. When he appealed the conviction, none other than Jerry Owen supplied an affidavit on his behalf. Owen claimed that he was introduced to Devins by Weber, who said, quote, Curly, which was Jerry Owen's nickname, this is Mr. Devins. Mr. Devins, this is Curly Owen. He is a minister. Several months later, Owen and Devins met on the Sunset Strip, and Devins tried to get Owen to say he overheard Weber solicit the bribe, quote, to give to somebody downtown to take care of the thing, unquote. Owen said he answered, no, I didn't hear that. So in other words, Owen is going into court on the attorney Weber's behalf, claiming that Devins tried to bribe him to say that Weber was soliciting bribes. Okay. Owen said he answered, no, I didn't hear that. The California Supreme Court, in denying Weber's appeal, opined that, quote, Owen's testimony was incredible and, quote, full of discrepancies and suspicious statements, unquote. Owen said he answered, no, I didn't hear that.